Rory Groves is the author. There's a foreword by Alan C. Carlson. It's called Durable Trades. We have it in hardback and paperback at shop.mikechurch.com. Family-centered economies that have stood the test of time. And Rory is on our Skype Maker hotline here to join us. We're going to talk about this. You guys are going to want to take notes because there's going to be a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about. Rory, nice to meet you. Thank you for being on the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, the last live radio station standing. How are you?
Doing very well. Appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, anytime. Glad to have you. I just saw your picture on Skype, and you're a younger guy than I thought you were. I thought you were a G. Edward Griffin type, that you've been doing this for decades, but no.
Well, I've been doing some of it for decades, but I guess I'm not at the end of my career yet.
Tell the folks, if you would, a little bit about the foreword by Alan C. Carlson, by the way, is worth reading for all of you to get the book, read it. The introduction against obsolescence is also worth reading. You know, people usually skip those things. Don't skip the first parts. Tell the folks out there, what were you doing before you got the idea or the calling to write Durable Trades?
Yeah, what I tell people is that I didn't set out to write a book. This was just a question that was burning in my mind after 20 years of being a self-employed computer programmer. I was really getting frustrated with just the way things would constantly go obsolete all the time. Now, like when you're young, you love that. You love the novel and modern changes, and everything new is always better, right? You kind of have that mentality when you're just starting out. But I'll tell you what, after a while, you start to crave for things that are stable, things that will last, things that can be even multi-generational. And so over the course of time, this question in my mind started to just come up more and more, is that, am I really putting my effort, my time, my energy towards something that's durable, something that will last? Or am I just, you know, part of the problem? Am I just creating things that are just made to go obsolete so quickly? And I started doing some research about this concept of family economies or family-centered economies. Okay. And Alan Carlson was definitely one of the key proponents of this. And there's also a pastor in Colorado named Kevin Swanson. And when I started to read that, that's really when things started to, a bell started to go off in my mind, in that looking at, boy, it's not only possible to build things that will last, but it's possible to do it with your family. And for me, we have five kids. We're here in southern Minnesota. We homeschool our kids. We love our family. We want everything that's God's best for our family. So for me, this was a huge shift in my paradigm in terms of what I, as a father, should be doing with my vocation, not just something to make a paycheck and make as much money as possible, but is there something that I can do with my family and build something that'll last for generations?
And by the way, Dr. Alan C. Carlson is the John A. Howard Distinguished Fellow for Family and Religious Studies at the International Organization for the Family and editor of the Natural Family and International Journal of Research and Policy. He's written 15 books, including The Natural Family, Where It Belongs, New Agrarian Essay. So when I'm reading the introduction, I'm going like, wait a minute, I read this before. This is the 12 guys, I'll take my stand.
That's it, Southern Agrarians.
The Southern Agrarians. I mean, the imprint of the Southern Agrarians and those men that wrote those essays is all over the first three chapters of the book. Yeah. No, it really is, to your credit. And I wanted to start talking with you about this and to just kind of flesh out where we're going or where you're going with this. There's a couple of things that I already heard you say. Homeschooling, living at the home, you wanted something that's durable. You mentioned obsolete. I've talked about this for a decade and a half now. It's called forced obsolescence. And I was unaware of it, Rory, until I went to go buy a dishwasher replacement. I just moved into this house in 2007. There we are in 2011, and this fancy schmancy stainless steel dishwasher is on the kaput. So I go to the Home Depot, Lowe's, wherever it was, and we're trying to find one, and there's not that big of a selection any longer. And then I'm talking to the guy about, I said, well, should I get the extended warranty or parts readily available for this? He just laughed. Mm. And he went, sir, these machines are built to be done, to be used for 4 to 6 years, and then you throw it in the scrap heap and you buy a new one.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's insane.
It's done. It's not as though they can't make a dishwasher that could last I was talking about this the other day, Rory. I have a 1995, circa 1995, Kenmore refrigerator freezer. Mm-hmm. That joker, I'm on my fourth GE or LG. That thing, when the other ones go out, I move everything in to the Kenmore because it's built to last.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating how all the newer appliances that you're getting now, they just don't last as long as the ones you're replacing? I mean, it's across the board.
In the early part of the book, and I could just see the research that went into this, you go all the way back. I believe your touchstone moment is 1800, right?
Yeah, 1790 is kind of the start point. That's where officially the Bill of Rights is ratified, right, and the country comes together. So 1790 is the starting point.
Okay, so what do you discover about how the U.S. government in its early stages, how it classifies or quantifies vocations, occupations, whatever you wish to call them, and how many of them were there?
Mm. Yeah, so going back to the earlier part of the later part of the 18th century, we have roughly about 70 distinct occupations in this country. And going back even earlier than that, it's only, there's only maybe about 30, 40, 50 distinct occupations. So we're talking over a period of centuries. There's pretty much a stable set of occupations that you could get involved in.
And they are they become the durable trades.
So what I did for the research is I looked at all the occupations that were around before the Industrial Revolution, right? So which is kicked off in 1790, ran roughly through the middle of the 18th century. And really we're still seeing the Industrial Revolution today, at least the mindset of it. Over that period from 1790, we went from 70 distinct professions to over 30,000 today.
Wow.
Just to give you a mindset. And what's really interesting about it is that most, if not all, of the professions that came out of the Industrial Revolution were also destroyed by the Industrial Revolution. In other words, telegraph operators and switchboard operators and all kinds of technologies that came up, they spawned new professions for maybe a decade or so, and then they were gone. But you have these durable trades, what I call durable trades, that have persisted through all of that. And not only the Industrial Revolution, but they've survived, all kinds of upheavals, societal upheaval, revolutions, wars, economic hyperinflation, pandemics. You know, we've had pandemics in this country before. It has happened. This isn't the first time this has ever happened in human history. But these are the trades. Not all of them survived, but most of them from that 18th century are still with us today, and they afford families today a very good opportunity, if they would desire, to pursue something that's not only long-lasting and can earn a good income, but they can also do it with their family. Because you go back to the 18th century and any time before the Industrial Revolution, and the family was an economic unit.
Yes.
The whole idea of work was to work together as a family on a common purpose, on a common vocation.
So then in the early part of the Durable Trades book with Rory Graves here, get your copy at shop.mikechurch.com. One of the things that we learned in the early part of the book is that prior to the Industrial Revolution, Rory, you had primary, secondary, and then some tertiary parts of any of these occupations. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. You talk about the primary sector activities and the secondary. So primary sector activities are those which are directly involved with harvesting resources from the earth, right? It might be farming, might be mining, might be logging. So this is very close to the land. People were living very close to the land. And secondary sector activities would include manufacturing. So turning those raw materials into something that has an improved value and availability for a larger population who can't directly farm the land. Tertiary activities is the service sector.
Okay.
And so I think by where you're going with this is that we see a radical shift over the nation's populace and where people's jobs were, where their vocations were in these sectors compared to today.
And then after the Industrial Revolution, or as it's going on, we had a fourth.
Yeah, the quaternary.
Yes.
So then there's a that's where we get the idea of knowledge workers. So you have primary, which is working with the land. You have manufacturing. You have services, which includes any kind of services that could be banking. That could be some kind of like tailoring services, like mending or altering, any kind of housekeeping services, all kinds of hospitality services. And then on top of the services, we evolved into this quaternary sector, which is the highly knowledge-oriented type of profession, scientific, you know, computer technology. Those
right.
are all parts of the quaternary sector.
So, and we see this all around. Almost everyone you and I know, unless they're homeschooling farming like you are, is probably in a quaternary. Most of the people that have a job or are working at some kind of occupation or career, whatever they wish to call it today, are either working tertiary or quaternary. Now, this is what I thought was the most fascinating and shocking part of the book, Durable Trades, your research as we get into some of the details. And that is at the turn of the 19th century, about 90-some-odd percent of most Americans, or maybe I'm off on the date, were involved in primary. Today, it's did you write? Now you wrote this a year and a half ago. Less than 3%, or than 5%?
No, 2%.
2%,
probably less than that. That was as of 2010.
How is that possible? How can we survive with 2% of the population working in what used to be primary?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, we've offshored a lot of that.
Okay.
I mean, the manufacturing and the secondary and the primary sectors of the economy were well over 80% of the population in 1900 were involved in that.
Okay.
And, you know, when I lay it out in the book, you look at that, it's like a very stable pyramid. You have basically equal distribution of employment across these sectors. Today, where you only have 2% of the population involved in primary sector activities, which is the agriculture, the mining, fishing, forestry, hunting, and you have a very small, I think we're below 20%, maybe below 15% of the population is involved in manufacturing.
Okay.
So you have over, you know, 80% of the population that's involved in services and quaternary sector activities, which they all rely on the first two sectors. That's the whole thing. You can't have a society that doesn't have manufacturing and agriculture.
Right.
If you're depending on other societies to provide those things for you, it's an incredibly unstable foundation.
Now, in the chapter, The Challenge Ahead, which is the first chapter as we get towards the end, there's a subheading of the robots are coming, the robots are coming. And then the next thing, the next subheading is all about the killer toasters. Our listeners are going to find that kind of fortuitous, or maybe serendipitous, that's a better word, because one of the first episodes here on the Crusade Channel back in December of 2015 was a show called Reverse Deception, and the show was all about the appliances you have in your home that are spying on you. Mm-hmm. This is in 2015.
Wow.
And and Greg Carpenter was saying, you have a Wi-Fi in your refrigerator? Give it the wrong password. That's what he would say. Go ahead and use it. Just give it the wrong password so that nobody can get in and no one can get out. You're right about killer toasters here. This is real. There are killer toasters. There's killer command devices. Alexa, dude, or whatever. Yeah. You know, when I see what Boston Robotics is doing, and I see these robots that can now jump and hop on one leg and do backflips off of tables, I don't get excited. I get terrified, and I go rewatch The Terminator.
Yeah. No, believe me, that's come to mind a couple of times. We're so eager to advance the technical progress at any measure possible. See, this is part of the thing of a capitalist economy where you have bad actors calling the shots. And they pursue profit at any expense without really restraining the idea of what is this going to do to human relationships? What's this going to do to communities? And what's this going to do to humanity in general? Because, yeah, the whole idea of killer toasters is that one of the there was a big takedown of the internet about, well, right about the time you had that show. I think it was back in 2015, maybe 2016. But the internet itself was designed by the government, by the military,
DARPA,
to withstand a direct nuclear attack. So they could still communicate with each other and there would be no singular site of takedown. By, you know, under the Cold War, under communism, we'd still be able to communicate. That was the whole concept of the internet. It's an internet, it's a network of networks. And the killer toasters thing was that because of all these Internet of Things, all these appliances that are internet connected, hackers, and ironically, probably Russian hackers, have been able to infiltrate millions of American appliances and use those appliances as a base to launch attacks against American security targets. And so what one of the security experts said is that we've taken a system built to resist destruction by nuclear weapons and made it vulnerable to toasters. So this is kind of some of the things that goes along with, if you're not thinking these things through, you can have some really bad results, and it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak.
So we're talking with Rory Groves, the author of Durable Trades, Family-Centered Economies That Have Stood the Test of Time. Let's move up to Chapter 2 now. And this is where I started making notes and underlining things, and I've scarred my book up so I can't ever sell it. And if I do, it'll wind up in a used bookstore and someone will go, who is scribbling all over this book? I'm like G.K. Chesterton. You know you got a book that Chesterton had because there'd be more writing by him in the margins than there were on the pages here. Under the fractured families, which is where I think what you're talking writing about and what we talk about here on the Crusade Channel often, and I don't know if Dan Mundy told you this, but we have a little show that we do every Friday. It's called Free Farm Friday. It came up organically, not ironically, and I would say it is the most successful one-hour segment, and I do 20 hours a week. It's the most successful one-hour segment that I had nothing to do with creating in a 30-year career in broadcasting. It took off, and it continues to take off. It's well listened to. People listen to it. It's well participated in. It drives conversations, Rory. It drives thought process. And the thing that's the coolest part about it to me, or the most fascinating and encouraging part about it to me is, it seems to sink in without explanation beyond Dan talking about his livestock and his love for heirloom livestocking. Brian talking about, and they live 1,000 miles apart. He in Central Jersey, Brian in Southeast Texas, and then there are all points in between. We had the candle lady on. We had the cheese making lady on. There is a growing desire to go like, well, to go back and go, okay, how do we undo some of this? And I believe that this is directly tied to people like me that go and they see this fractured family that you write about in Chapter 2. So let's talk about the fractured family aspect.
Yeah, I'll comment just to confirm what you're saying is in the last probably 6 weeks, we've heard from six families who are either buying a farm or looking now to move to a farm, because we get contacted all the time for our conversations regarding the book. And I can't think of any other period in my life where I've heard that many people all at once really seized with this desire to get their families out into the country to start doing something productive together as a family. So for me, it's very encouraging. And I think that that's a great opportunity. And we'll get into it here. You don't have to be a farmer in order to have a whole family, but that's certainly a tradition in this country that goes way, way back.
So according to the Massachusetts Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of the notes that I made on this page about comparative rate wages, I found this interesting, so I share it with the audience. The apprentice system was in vogue, and all parts of a trade were then taught, where it is now usual and needful to teach but a single branch. The youths who aspired to become a shoemaker might, for instance, during his period of apprenticeship, acquire knowledge of every step from the tanning of the leather to its embodiment in the finished shoe. It's according to the Massachusetts Bureau of Statistics and Comparative Wages. That is a fascinating little thing to think that a government, quasi-government entity, was writing this, I assume, recently, but was looking back on what once was. Apprenticeships. You know, we had President Obama made it illegal to have apprentices. I could not hire or could not, we could not have interns when I was working at Sirius XM after Obama got Congress, got Pelosi to pass that that piece of legislation. They specifically went after internships, which in broadcasting are apprenticeships. You learn everything. And that's what this is writing. This is what this is talking about, right?
Oh, of course. And the writing was back in the 1920s, actually, where I lifted that from. And what's fascinating about it is if you read the full context of that quote, they were talking derisively about the old way of doing things. This was before the miracle of the machine, you know, saved us all from having to have human relationships. I mean, they didn't put it that way, but it's like, you know, God forbid if we ever have people doing more than they have to do, pushing more than pushing a single button or pulling a single lever. You know, we're so much more advanced now. We don't have to rely on these apprenticeships in order to advance our manufacturing sector. So that mentality really came out of the progressive era in the early 1900s, where progress was viewed as everything that's different from the way we used to do it, of course. And that's applied to all areas of life. And it's definitely still with us. I think that's why you see legislation effectively banning internships and apprenticeships and forcing people into a position where it really no longer makes sense to bring interns on. You know, the alternative is those interns have to go get a college degree and rack up $100,000 in debt before they can even try working in the field of choice and experience a little bit about what work entails. So I don't know how that is an advantage to anybody, but I am a huge proponent of apprenticeships, because that's where you learn.
And the amazing thing about this is, and all of this discussion here, again, folks, ladies and gentlemen, it all makes common sense. You don't need degrees and titles to figure this out. So let's just take, for example, what you just said. $100,000, 4 to 5 to 6 years of one's life, put on hold to go obtain a piece of paper that in all likelihood, unless it's in one of the durable trades, in a manner of 5, 10, 15, 20 years, is going to be obsolete.
That's right.
You will learn, you know, the kid will trade learning as he worked and probably being paid a stipend instead of him paying or the family paying. They're probably being paid to learn the trade. We've traded that for, well, let's reverse that. Let's just turn this upside down. You know, for anyone that doesn't think that there's some diabolical influence there, I just challenge you, you're going to have to make a believer out of me, because that destroys so many connections. Family, community, small, local, regional, government. You know, everything then becomes, what an irony, pan, right? Across the entire continent. You quote Thomas Jefferson in here about the building of industrial landscapes. Dependence begets subservience and venality. suffocates the germ of virtue and prepares fit tools for the designs of ambition. He's warning. Mm-hmm. He was a I'll take my stand guy before the I'll take my stand guys.
He would have fit right in.
He would have fit right in. We're talking with Rory Groves of Durable Trades here. There's so much that we could go over here in the Industrial Revolution about families and living on family farms. Why don't you remind people of, because you write about this in this chapter, of what this supposed miserable existence was like on a family farm prior to the Industrial Revolution?
Well, yeah, I mean, families, you know, they worked hard, probably a lot harder than most of us are accustomed to. But what they were doing is they were subsisting on the land. Everything that they needed, they produced. There's a quote in there from one of the earlier writers. It says that prior to the Industrial Revolution, every home was a self-producing and self-sustaining community. Now, to me, that's just as crazy of an idea as science fiction could make it out to be. I can't even imagine that, but that was the normal way of things. Homes were self-sufficient. And you know what? You talk about Thomas Jefferson, why he said that. You know, he was a huge proponent of the yeoman farmer and the self-sufficient life. The reason he was a proponent of those things is because he saw that was the only way to sustain liberty in this country. You can't have a majority, 98% of the population, dependent on either multinational corporations or government or 2% of the population to feed themselves and maintain a sense of liberty like our founders knew it. You have to be self-sufficient. So families who work together on a farm, you know, there's such a wonderful opportunity in that kind of an agrarian setting, because everyone from a young child to an elderly adult can have very meaningful work. They have a place. They're needed, but they can also be cared for. There's a lot of opportunities, unlike other vocations, where in farming and taking care of animals, there's just more opportunities for families to work together. Now, that's not to say that's the only way that families can work together, and not everyone's going to be called to be farmers. But that is probably one of the top ways, and for centuries and for millennia, that's how families did it. They survived together on their own property, and they were free people.
Rory Groves, author of Durable Trades. Get your copy of this book. I say get it. All of you are going to want a copy of, especially when I tell you what comes after all of this. Go to shop.mikechurch.com. Choose hardback or paperback. One of the anecdotes that's in that chapter, and I think I had heard this before, but I haven't heard it in a while, Rory, was that here's an amazing little factoid. During the Great Depression, families, see, he knows where I'm going with this. Families that lived on farms, when they would venture into the city, they didn't even know there was a Great Depression, did they?
Yeah, I mean, depending on who you talk to, there are families, we have family members that were alive during the Great Depression, and they didn't know they were in a depression. Their barns, you know, had their livestock in them. They had all of the work that they needed. They had food on the table every day. They were not suffering in the way that people who were wholly dependent on a stock market, for example, or jobs in the city or population centers. They just weren't dependent on that. And that goes right back to what I was saying before. They were free people. They relied on each other and on their local community, which is another key aspect of this. Local economies have to be resurgent. We have to rely on each other locally. We can't rely on China for everything we need. If we want to be free, it's not just a matter of legislation. You have to be able to produce it locally and sustain each other locally.
Now, let's skip forward. We're covering a lot of ground here, folks, but there is super detail in the book, so get the book. Can you define what is durable for us?
Mm-hmm. So durable, I had to come up with, again, going back to what I had said earlier, this was a burning question in my mind for our own family. It wasn't originally a book idea.
Okay.
I just wanted to know, where can we go? And what would qualify as durable then? So what I decided to do is to look at anything that had survived the Industrial Revolution, if I were to sum it up. If a profession had survived since 1790, to today, then it means it's survived all of these other disruptions, right? Recessions and depressions and wars and revolutions and changes in government, and there's hyperinflation and all kinds of different challenges have happened over that period. So that's where I came up with kind of the cutoff, like the test of if something was going to be included in the book. And I looked at all the professions that existed before that period of time, and we're still around today. And in what I did then is I interviewed families who were working in those professions to kind of get an idea of what is a day in a life in the life like working as, say, a woodworker or a carpenter or an innkeeper or a jewelry maker, a silversmith. What are some of these professions like to kind of, you know, in this day and age, what does it feel like? What does it look like to be a fifth generation farmer today? So that's kind of where that the definition of durable comes from.
Okay, so then we break down, we're going to get into the actual durable trades, but you break down the kind of performance of each the durables by historical stability, resiliency, family-centeredness, income, and then ease of entry. And each one right. will then get a percentage point, a kind of a score that you go through. So that's how we get into the into durable trades and durable into what durable is. Now, the part I left out, because we just don't have enough time here, but I want people to read the book. Point I left out in the beginning part of the book, Rory also covers the destruction of currency, which almost every industrial or leap forward revolution does. It destroys the currency. It devalues it. It raises the debt. Well, folks, when they write the history of this epic, they're going to write that nothing could have prepared the planet for the destruction of currency that would have been seen in the 20th and 21st century. And as you write, there's a rule. This will not last. This will come to an end, which is why we need durable trades in order to survive it. That's kind of your point of the whole setup for the book, right?
Correct. Yeah. Stein's law says something that can't go on forever will stop. And so the families who are aware of this, who are paying attention, who are thinking about these things, now is the time to start making preparations, to start shifting your course so that you are not caught off guard when the inevitable happens.
Now, I am just just I had never considered, if you go all the way to the end of the book, I think you got 60, you list 60.
61 trades 60. Is what I came up with.
Okay, yep. 61 trades. But let's just focus on, I mean, we could talk a little bit about the other ones. We have a top 20. Mm-hmm. No one is going to, you people, if you're, I used to do this joke when I was on Sirius XM, if you're driving, pull over. If you're standing, sit down, because you're not prepared to hear this, because these trades endure. They are durable. And when I tell you what some of them are in the top 20, you're going to go like, come on, King Dude, no one actually, well, apparently, yes, someone actually does. You know, and as I'm reading your book, I'm just thinking, and I don't know if you reached out to him or not, I'm just thinking, Mike Rowe.
Oh, yeah. No, we have. If you know Mike, give him a plug for me.
I do not know Mike.
We're trying to get a hold of him.
I do not know Mike Rowe, but he would love this book, and he would love to. And look, he's been to these places.
Yeah.
He's been to a lot of these places.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask a question in the chat room. No cheating, you guys that have the book. If you had to guess, so go ahead and make a guess, crusadechannel.com/chat. If you had to hazard a guess of the five qualifications that we just laid out, historical stability, resiliency, family-centeredness, income, and ease of entry, what do you think, and it's number one by a pretty decent margin, what would you think is the number one trade that this book covers anyways? I think it's fair to say that this will hold up all the way back to Cain and Abel. You guys guess in the chat room, what would you say is the number one trade? And everyone knows it. All right, now, Josh K., be more specific. You guys are bouncing around with the issue here. So, Rory, was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, there were other, yeah, when I, so on those five things that you mentioned, when I did, what folks need to understand is that I came up with a scoring system. So every trade had a score according to certain aspects of its durability. Mainly when we talk about historical stability, we want to look at how much has the trade changed, because you still have farming, for example, that from the 18th century, but farming looks very different today than it did in the 18th century.
Right.
And so I wanted to kind of account for those things. I also, it was important that income isn't the number one, you know, priority. Family centeredness is the number one priority. The family centered trades are the most durable trades and have been through history. So, yeah, so when I actually ended up starting to score some of these things, I was surprised, but as I reflected on it, it really made a lot of sense to me which ones kind of sorted out in the top 10 or top 20.
Okay, so number one, I feel like Casey Kasem now, on with Casey's countdown. Number one, Shepherd. Shepherd. And I'm thinking, like, you mean like the shepherds were tending their flocks and they heard Gloria and Excelsis Deo? You mean shepherd like that? That's exactly what you mean, isn't it?
Yeah. Shepherd. Yeah. Anyone, it's animal husbandry is the number one.
Well, so most durable we have a bunch of, we have four answers that said animal husbandry. So you guys got it right. Animal husbandry. And, but Rory, I think just looking at your list here, and I'll get into some of the other ones, it makes complete pragmatic sense. It makes complete economic sense if you trace the word economy to its etymology. You'll mm-hmm. find it's a Greek word, economos, or economos, which means as kind of the running of the household. You know, the wife right. would be the person in charge of the economos of the household. That's where we get economy from. So even when we talk about economy, we so perverted and bastardized that. We should be talking about the economy of your home. I don't care what the economy of the city is. Yeah. Should be worried about the economy of your home. But it makes sense. So shepherd, farmer. Now just think of this, the great circle of life here, sort of. Shepherd, farmer, number two. Number three, midwife. Number four, gardener, woodworker, carpenter, painter, cook, brewer. And I'm going like, come on, I got to have the booze guy in there. Sure enough. Brewer and then innkeeper round out the top 10. Rory, that's our village.
that's a good way to put it. I think three of the top five and 12 of the top 20 trades, this is key to understand, were about food, fiber, and shelter. Right. So the trades catering to core human needs, they just will always be there. They may take different forms or fashions, but those are incredibly durable. And of course, like you said, it makes sense.
And then you go now rounding out the 20, innkeeper. So mm-hmm. now, okay, we're going to have communities. You know, Mary and Joseph went to go stay in an inn. You think innkeeper, you think Marriott. Well, not really. Yeah. There have been so many attempts to kind of address what has been lost. One of my favorite Pixar movies is the first Cars movie, because it shows what Eisenhower's interstate did to little towns. Mm. I think that's the point that Lasseter was trying to would make with the film, you know, and I think it made a point very well. You know, it showed the damage that had been done by superhighways. Mm. Yeah, but it's economical. We got to get stuff. It's destructive.
Mm-hmm. It's efficient, right?
Yes, that's right. And the efficient cause cannot ever be the primary cause.
Exactly.
So we get into to your key findings here. And I'm just you go through very detailed descriptions of the top 10 or so. And then they get a little bit more sparse as we go on. But there's some occupations in here or vocations here. Like, for example, like in the top 20, we have interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a surprise?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Language interpreters, incredibly durable. I mean, I hadn't even thought about that, but you find examples all over Scripture of, when Joseph's brothers came to visit him in Egypt,
right,
before they knew he was Joseph, he spoke to them through an interpreter. So what's that? Maybe 4,000 years ago. I'm not quite sure when that. So and we had them all over. I mean, they were constantly in need in every culture and in every society.
Silversmith. Mm. Now, is a silversmith is not the same as a blacksmith, or is it?
No, different. A silversmith is more concerned with jewelry making.
Okay.
Or fine art.
And then you have some of the other top 20. And again, these all make perfect sense. Tutor.
Mm-hmm.
Tutor.
Mm-hmm.
There is, and again, scripturally speaking, there are tutors. Mm-hmm. There are always tutors. Someone to teach someone else a trade or skill or maybe a language or something.
Yeah, we had public school wasn't a thing in this country up until about the mid-19th century. And again, a lot of that I go into the book about it in the book too. The factories needed workers.
That's right.
And public schools came on the scene at the same time. So, but before the public schools, children were educated in the home all the way back. I mean, George Washington was homeschooled.
Yes, he was.
And so when you have a largely home-based educational paradigm, there's a need for specialty teachers. And that's always been around. People who teach music, or maybe people would teach certain subjects in more depth if they wanted to send their students to learn a little bit more detail about a particular topic, or to, like you said, to apprentice. Someone had to do that teaching. And that's where tutors come in.
And rounding out the top 10 and durable trades, number 9, you guys are going to love this, brewers. Brewer, winemaker, always in need. There's always been wine. There's always been some kind of distilled spirit. But the fact that that the brewer makes it into the top 10, and he does pretty good. He scores pretty good.
Yeah, I mentioned in the book that children can participate in all aspects of the trade except for consuming the product legally. So it's kind of an ironic thing to have in there on a book about family-centered trades, but it really is a family-centered trade. And there are wineries that have been in the same family for 10 centuries. 10 centuries.
10 centuries. There's a, Mitish Chur and I are watching this, and I encourage everyone to watch this show and shows like it if you can find him. It's Stanley Tucci's In Search of Italy. And Stanley Tucci, the famous actor, he's many, many generation Italian, and he wants to go to Italy. He wants to find out if the ancient culture and history is still alive. And to his surprise, he finds it everywhere. And he finds older people primarily that are defending and practicing these trades and lamenting the fact that the Utes found it, like winemaking, for example, too difficult, and they fled. But like, for example, he finds a winery on the island of Sicily, and he goes, I didn't even know there was wine made on Sicily. Mm-hmm. And then the woman shows us, she goes, all of that was once vineyard. And you're just far as the eye can see. But he manages to find all of these awesome old, everything in your book he found in Italy.
Wow.
Every single vocation he found in Italy. And there's a couple things that are in common I've talked about. Everywhere he goes, there's love. He's greeted with, but these people that are working the land or keeping these durable trades alive, Rory, they're the most friendly, loving people you're ever going to meet. They're of the land. You're not going to find very many arrogant farmers or shepherds, I don't think.
No, you won't. They have a way of humbling you. Animals can humble you mighty quickly.
An animal can humble you. But everywhere he goes and he finds someone practicing and defending, and they don't make any apologies before. And they was like, well, what else would I do? When they're asked the questions, when he asked the nonas who are still hand-making pasta when they could just go down the street and buy it in a plastic bag. And he goes, why would I want to do that?
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because it really comes back to that conversation about efficiency. We made efficiency the highest virtue somewhere around, you know, the 18th century. And prior to that, and, you know, not, it's not that everyone, no one was interested in wealth before that. I mean, they would have, a lot of cultures would have loved to have more wealth before that. But you have to go back to a more fundamental question to ask, why are we here?
Right.
You know, why did, when God created man, why did he put him in a garden and not in an office building?
There you right? go. Why,
or a factory floor? There's something beyond just the monetary exchange value of the things that we manufacture. The rivers of commodities that flow through our homes without ever belonging here, as one of the Southern agrarians put it. Are we really meant to be close to the land, close to nature, those primary sector activities? Or are we meant to be locked away in a cubicle somewhere and then just kind of making it back up on the other side with a paycheck? There's something much deeper at stake here than purely looking at the dollars and cents of it all.
Now, I would like to put you in touch with my friend, and you may already know of him. Maybe you're in touch with him. Wade Ratzi, who is kind of the dean. He runs the American the American Academy of Building Arts in Charleston, South Carolina. Number 22 is plasterer. Wade is now training at this college. This is a building arts college. He has ironworking, plastering, masonry, timber framing. Awesome. Wayne is now training an entire class full of young men and young some young women in these building arts. And plasterer Rory, he says, he goes, Mike, when my kids graduate, they have work in restoration alone for life.
Absolutely.
He goes, they will be employed for, they will be gainfully doing plaster work if they want to for the rest of their lives, because there's so much history to be preserved in so many buildings, and no one knows how to repair or even add to, maybe connect a new room that they want plastered to an old one.
Mm. That is so true, and that's the case across the board with building trades. Plasterer is one of the prime examples. There's just so few people that are coming up through the ranks to take these jobs. And you talk to these guys who are builders, and they'll continue to say, you know, the average age is, you know, 55, 60 years old for the building trades. And, you know, they're going to be retiring. It's not going to be too long. And they can pretty much name their price if they're competent. And people have to wait in line. Sometimes the carpenter I interviewed, people wait in line for him for up to a year. And so, but there's a big problem there, because there's going to be a massive shortage of people who are going to step into these roles. There aren't young people coming up through the ranks. So whenever I hear that there are schools opening or that there are apprenticeships offered in these kinds of skills, man, I would say get those skills. Even if you can't see yourself working for a lifetime in that vocation, that is the marketable skill to have today.
You know, I know some young men around here, and one of them has taken to kind of apprenticing with a local, some people they would call him a blacksmith. He's not a blacksmith. He's a farrier. He's a horseshoe guy. You're always going to need people that can shoe horses. Yep. And, you know, here in the United States, I don't know if you know this or it's in the book because I didn't get this far. And I've told people this, and they look at me and they stare at me like, you're nuts. And I'm like, no, I'm not nuts. There is still a union, a guild, the Journeyman Horseshoers Union, the JHU. You can't get on some racetracks here in Louisiana. It's a law. You have to be certified by, you got to be in the guild, basically. You have to be in the Journeyman Horseshoers Union, because it's the union that's going to say, not the state, it's the union that's going to say, we tested that guy. He passes our specs. Mm. He knows what he's doing. Is there anything in the book about guilds?
Just tangentially,
okay.
I think the metalworking has a quotation from one of the blacksmith guilds of the Middle Ages. It was, by hammer and hand, all arts do stand. And but I don't go into detail about that period of history in Europe when we had a lot more of that, when they were the ones that were overseeing the apprenticeships and the validation of and the protection of their members in the sense of not allowing outside influence to destroy what they were producing and their families were subsisting on.
And you wouldn't think this, but a durable trade musician, artist, that's a durable trade. That's two parts of the quadrivium. is rhetorician in here too? Is speaker in here? Because that would be three of the four.
Orator is not one of them.
No. Okay. Well, I'm in trouble then.
Well, pick something up on the side.
I'm going to pick up carpentry and plastering, I think.
Plastering would be a good one to pick up.
Miners, bankers, couriers, statesmen, professors, nannies. Now, most people wouldn't think like, well, how is a nanny a durable trade? You want to explain that one?
It's just one of the trades that was pre-existing the revolution and still with us today. And it goes way back. It basically, a nanny can also be someone who was served as a maid in earlier times. Housekeeping could be considered under that trade, under that term, because that's typically what the kind of services that nannies provided. But the care of young children, but with the assistance of other people is very long lasting type of a profession. Now, one thing to mention is you're reading off some of these, they're ranked from top to bottom. So right. The most durable and more specifically, the most family centered trades are the ones at the top.
Okay.
So when you're getting down towards the bottom, you're getting down to trades that have been around, they're durable, but they're not necessarily the most family centered trades. And that's all reflected in the scoring. And I usually write about some of the challenges. So for example, for a nanny, that makes sense for a young woman to be involved with that kind of work. But when she has a family of her own, she can't really bring her kids along. Although in some cases, nannies will do some of that. But it's difficult to keep the whole family together as a nanny as compared to, say, being a silversmith and working from a home workshop.
Yeah, and then you have things like the sailor, for example. There's always been sailors. Soldiers already at the bottom of the list. That's understandable. Somewhere in the 50s, and this makes, again, practical sense, cartographer. Well, of course, because a cartographer is going to have to leave home
to
go cartography, to go survey. But I can tell you, again, and I think the scarcity of them probably today would also point out some of their durability. I needed to get a surveyor to survey a piece of property so that I can begin planning my new country base in the middle of nowhere homestead, which is being planned in earnest now. I had to wait. I got on a waiting list. I talked to after about 20 phone calls. Nope, can't do it. Nope, not too small of a job. Or out of business or whatever the case may be. I finally found one gentleman who said, I can do it, but you are 10 to 14 weeks out, depending on the weather, from me being able to get it. I said, put me on the list. and it took 10 weeks, but it did get done. And there's a serious set of skills that went with that survey. I mean, he had to know, he had to find a benchmark in order to do the work. So all of these durable trades, all these skills, you can see, I think, them coming back slowly, but their necessity will be revealed, I believe, as more people do what you and your wife did. Decide that, well, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be in this city anymore. The more self-sufficient you become, it would seem to me, especially if you're homesteading or anything of that sort, then the more reliable you're going to be on those durable trades.
And some I'd offer in on this too. Some people look over these trades and they kind of question if that makes sense for their family to go this direction or that direction. Most families in history's practiced multiple trades. And I go into that in the book is to look for opportunities to practice multiple overlapping trades, because it's one thing to try to say become a specialty breeder and earn a living off of just that one thing. But if you could maybe make a fifth of your income off of specialty breed animals of, you know, whatever, dogs or ponies or alpacas. That's a different would you say goalpost, mm-hmm. and it's more achievable. And then you do something else. Maybe you do some woodworking and some carpentry, and across multiple trades, you can actually subsist quite comfortably. And at the same time, you're more diversified in the risk portfolio, so to speak. And so, look to be self-sufficient as you can. Raise as much of your own food, provide for your own necessities as you can,
right.
So you don't have to exchange your labor for money. And that's where a lot of it gets lost in the process. But then look for opportunities where you can practice multiple trades or practice multiple activities and have multiple streams of income that makes you more resilient, like historical families were.
And by the way, you mentioned, we talked about plastering a couple of times. This would come up if we were building homes that we wanted to be around for four generations from now, because we were handing houses down to house, to daughter, to granddaughter, to great-granddaughter. Plaster is going to stand the test of time, and it has a component to it that, especially if you're in the deep south here, that's important. And that is, when it's not directly exposed to sunlight, it by nature is cool. It's cool to the touch. You put your hand on it, it's not hot. Even in the middle of the summer in St. Charles Avenue, if you go to an interior room of an old house that has plaster on the wall, put your hand on it, you're going to go like, hey, that's like, it's not hot. It has a cooling ability. So when people are like, how did they survive without air conditioning? They had concrete and plaster. They sheltered themselves. There's a couple things I wanted to just chat with you for a moment about here before we go. Now, I want all of you to go to the store and get a copy of this book so I can make a reorder and we put some more duckies in this guy's bank account so we can write the sequel. Go to shop.mikechurch.com, shop.mikechurch.com. I'm all about promoting you, bro.
I appreciate it. Thank
I'm
you.
All about promoting the trades. I met, and I don't know if I wouldn't know him, but I was blessed to have met. I met the fourth generation proprietor of the bourbon distillery company called Maker's Mark, Rob Samuels III. And, I kind of had a conversation like this, and for whatever reason, Rob seemed to be willing to tolerate my questions. And we had a great conversation over some Maker's Mark. If you look at a bottle of Maker's Mark, there's two marks on it that you would not see if I didn't tell you about them. And he told the story to me about it. And you covered this a little bit in one of the post chapters after the durable trades. You have the vital lie, which I'm going to ask you about in a minute, the dignity of work, and the discipleship of work. The Maker's Mark is basically what's known in your trades as the service mark. And there is a mark on every bottle of Maker's Marks. And you may wonder, if you look at it, go like, well, I wonder why they put that on there. That's their family. It's a brand, basically. Like, you brand cows. Theirs is, it's now SV. Before it would have been SIV. It's Samuels, the family, fifth generation making that bourbon. And they stamp it on the bottle. And the other mark is that his great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, when they first came out with the labels in the 30s, I think, they were making them by hand, and she had one of those pairs of scissors that makes decorative cuts. Instead of making a straight line, it cuts the kind of little semicircle joined to a semicircle. The labels, especially on the small batch ones, are still cut like that. So there's a Maker's Mark on there. You would find in most of these trades where they're making something that men would want to leave their mark. As I guess several different reasons you'd want to do that. Number one, what if someone needed to have the product serviced? Or what if someone wanted to have another one made? Well, then your service mark would then serve as your brand, I guess, before we had copyrights and logos and all that. Did you any research on that, or anything like that come up when you were researching and writing?
No, there's nothing like that in the book. That's a fascinating topic, though, especially when you talk about multi-generational, passing on the mark and making it their own. I spoke with, when I did interviews for the top 20 trades, I spoke with, and I always tried to find people who are multi-generational. So for example, the carpenter that I interviewed was a fourth generation carpenter, and his son is, looks like will probably go into carpentry as well. He had just recently graduated high school.
Okay.
And the silversmith was a second generation. So it's interesting because there's this standard of quality that follows in a generational family business that does not follow anything in like that in a corporation, because you constantly have a change of ownership. So when you're looking at it over a period of, you know, centuries, there is a standard there that is very fitting for something like a generational service mark. I like that, or maker's mark.
Yeah, no, and he was. I mean, he just lit up when I asked him about it. He couldn't wait to tell the story. So let's wrap all this up with Rory Groves and Durable Trades. Get your copy of the book in paperback or hardback at shop.mikechurch.com. We actually have them in stock. They arrived here yesterday from your publisher. Talk about what is the vital lie? Mm. Okay, what's the vital lie, Rory?
So the vital lie, this goes back to a playwright who once described a vital lie is a lie that everybody in the family would keep in order to protect the reputation of the family. And I think it was a Swedish playwright. And I was bouncing off of that idea to use it in our society, where there's this vital lie that everyone keeps, that that blue collar jobs, the jobs where you work with your hands, those are really kind of the low end jobs. Like, nobody really wants those jobs. They're dirty, right? Mike Rowe, dirty jobs. There's not a lot of money. You're really kind of at the bottom of the barrel if you have to do that. The real, you know, advantage is to get a white collar job, to be a knowledge worker, you know, to have the office hours, to have a comfortable office environment where, you know, you're not sweating. And I go into an example where there's a guy. It was actually the carpenter I interviewed for the book.
Okay.
His son was approached by a high school guidance counselor about some college options, and he said, "Oh, you know, you'd be a shoo-in for this grant money because your parents, they don't make a lot of money, right?" And so he sent him home with this piece of paper that kind of showed where on the spectrum he could earn, you know, he could get some assistance for college based on his parents' earning potential. And he brought him home to his mom and dad. And all that the high school guidance counselor knew was that his dad's a carpenter. And his mom does landscaping too. But that's all that they knew about him. And he just had this presumption. So the kid brings it home. He says, "Mom and Dad, where are we on this chart? My guidance counselor says that, you know, I maybe would qualify for some assistance." And he looks at it and he says, "Son, we're not on that chart." And the fact of the matter is, this couple, they bring in, their net worth is over $1 million. It was one full-time carpenter. He pretty much works alone. And his wife is working. Now the kids are older, so the wife works as a landscaper, and they have a family farm. They have machinery on their farm. They can do everything. Believe me, he has added a sawmill last year. So they can do everything, but they own their house outright. They're worth more than $1 million. They clear close to $500,000 a year,
carpet.
In these low paying manual labor jobs. So that's the vital lie.
So, but again, at the end of the day, it's not really all about how much you can earn. I mean, it's important, but the family life is higher on the scale. And then we closed our book out with the discipleship of work. I think that's as important as anything, because you know, people call it the work ethic. I talked to my daughter number one, the other day, a pair of twins. Well, of course, if they're twins, it's a pair. I repeat myself. I talked to daughter number one the other day, who's in New York City, after I pleaded and begged her not to do it, but she's insisting. But she has now While she was at LSU, she has 4 years, well, 3 full years of working at a retail fashion store, which is what the, I don't know where fashion is in the durable trades, when I'm sure seamstress or something was in there,
yeah,
right?
Taylor.
So she works in the women's fashion part of it. So she managed the store for 3 years. She got a major in fashion merchandising and a minor in business, which I insisted that she get. Now she's in New York, and she's on her second job with a fashion merchandising company. She's done the retail end of it. Now she's working on the marketing on the back end. And I talked to her the other day, and she said, "Well, because the marketing gig that she kind of has is coming up for renewal. They called it an internship." I said, "Madison, the reason they called it an internship, because in this climate here, it was basically to see whether or not you could provide something to them and they could keep you in-house." And I told her, I said, "At your age, with your experience and with your discipleship of work, if you will, your work ethic, you're not going anywhere. They're not going to let you leave." if they are smart, and I think those girls are, because they can't replace you. You are almost irreplaceable, because your generation is not, they do not have the discipleship of work. They have the discipleship of money, but they do not have the discipleship of work. And maybe I'm not even using your discipleship of work correctly. But why don't we close with that, and then a little bit about the future, Rory?
Well, I think, I mean, certainly work ethic is an integral part of all of that.
Okay.
And just to pause for a second on that point, you can't take our kids and just put them in a chair for 12 years and then release them into the workforce when they're 18 or 21 or whatever and expect them to have a functioning work ethic. I mean, if they're not working the whole time, I'd say from the age of 8 to begin them working in some kind of meaningful production in the family economy, they need to learn a work ethic as they mature. And that's one of the things that the family economy can do. If nothing else, you are afforded an opportunity to teach your children and prepare them for life in a very critical way, which the public schools will not do. They'll teach head knowledge, but they will not transfer this into working knowledge. You need to be able to do this, and there's no better context to do it than in the context of a family, where mom and dad are there, and they're discipling them, they're apprenticing them, not only in a skill transfer, but they're passing on their values. And this is what's missing in our modern educational paradigm. When we dropped apprenticeships, we dropped mentorships. Mentoring is taking young people, it's giving them skills, it's preparing them for life, but it's doing it with a certain purpose in mind, and that is you want to pass on the values of the parents. Mm. You want to pass on the faith of the parents and the ethics of the parents. That needs to be transmitted along with the skills, not just about making money, putting it in a bank and having a second vacation home or having big, a big retirement fund. That's not the point of life.
Right.
Life is to build character in our children. And so work is an ideal context. I think it's the ideal context to disciple our kids, because when you're working alongside your kids, you have opportunities to show how mom and dad react in different situations, whether they're either going to trust the Lord for their provision or if they're going to be despairing over where the next paycheck's going to come from. You have the opportunity to disciple your children in work, unlike any other venue that can be done. A Sunday school doesn't cut it. Work is an incredible place for that. And so if you have a family economy, that is a great way that you can bring your kids alongside and mentor and disciple them along the way.
And as far as the future goes, I see what we just talked about for the last 65 minutes. I see this becoming a more integral part of many more people and many more families' lives. I think from my chair, and I'm a little older than you, and I've been working at this trade now, this vocation, for 30 years. I've been blessed to do this. And I would just pass along to you that, and this has all happened in the course of the last 2 years, though. Now, I have a stable, I would say, of amazing young talent. I had one that actually came to me and said, I need a mentor. You sound like a mentor. Will you mentor me? But first I was shocked, and I went, yeah, of course. Some of the children, some of the younger generation out there, they, I think it's becoming apparent to them because they see the emptiness that the digital world and the robotic world and what have you here, the emptiness that at the end of the day it leaves you with. And for however they are seen, there is a fullness that is to be found out there on farms, on smaller homesteads, even in developments where maybe the parents are deciding, you know what? We take what land we have, we compost, we garden, we do what we can. Dad's the fixer-upper, unless it's a very, very special. He's learned how to do this and that and the other. I think that this is, from an existential point of view, is something that is has begun to happen, and we can pray that it will expand because I think it makes better and stronger communities.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, better families are going to make stronger, better communities. You're not going to have 70% of children can't wait, and for parents can't wait to. I know several that are can't wait for him to turn 18 to get out of my house. Yeah. Dude, that's just a terrible attitude, man. How did we ever get here? Now, maybe there were always been people that thought like that, but I think that the durable trades and the life that goes along with it. Making a comeback. You get the final word.
Yeah, it just makes me think about my wife shared with me this morning a passage from Daniel is when Cyrus in the Bible gave the word for the Jewish people to be able to return to their homeland and rebuild the temple. It's interesting what it said. It said that the people whose hearts had been moved by God returned. And when you actually look at the study, it was something around, I think they think it's about 10% of the population that was exiled actually returned. Even though they were all allowed to go, only about 10% returned. And I guess what I would say on that, my thought is that there are people whose hearts God is moving right now. Mm-hmm. And he's turning the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. And if God has put that move on your heart, step out in faith and just take the first step. You don't have to figure out everything all at once. Just take the first step and journey back toward the homeland, as it were. Try to look for ways that you can reintegrate your family into work and discipleship and mentorship, all the things we've been talking about. And then just see what the Lord has for you. See what blessing comes from that, because I don't think that you'll ever look back.
Wow, great way to end. Get the book, Durable Trades, Family-Centered Economies That Have Stood the Test of the Time, by Rory Groves. Are you working on anything else right now, or is this is your magnum opus? You're done.
We're actually I'm working on a study guide to go along with that. We've had a number of people contact us and say they're using this with their high school age students, and to kind of help them prepare for vocation. So the project right now is to kind of put together a study guide that would help people do a self-study course using this book.
Well, I think it's awesome, and I think homeschooling is going to explode. Homeschooling is going to explode. It's going to look like a mushroom cloud in many cities when they're finished with the destruction that they're wreaking on it. Rory, God bless you, and thank you for the generosity of your time, for the hard work that went into the book. As someone that's edited several volumes, I've never actually written one, but I've edited several of them, put some historical works back into print. I can appreciate the work that went into the research here and just gathering all that and how long that takes.
Thank you.
Looking forward then to the study guide coming out. He is Rory Groves. Now, if someone, you said you're talking to people, but someone does want to contact you about this, where may they find you?
Yeah, our website is thegrovestead.com. It's like my last name combined with the word homestead.
So I love that, the Grovestead.
Thegrovestead.com. And we, you know, it's just kind of a family blog, and we have contact information here. We try to host events here from time to time. And so if people are interested in any of that, just feel free to check us out. Last name combined with the word homestead.
So I love that, Grovestead.
Thegrovestead.com. And we, you know, it's just kind of a family blog, and we have contact information here. We try to host events here from time to time. And so if people are interested in any of that, just feel free to check us out.